This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to the show. I'm Mira Sevasodi. It's our Health and Living segment and it is our public health series with Azrul Muhammad Khalib, the CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. Today, Azrul, we're going to be talking about breast cancer and whether or not women have been left behind. Don't you think the guys are going to be really upset about this? Because already they feel breast cancer gets so much attention and so much funding and everything, and the boys just, you know, who cares about prostate cancer, isn't it?
No, I think it's time to talk about the women and girls who actually need more attention on their issues. I think they've been left behind when we look at the data, really.
Okay, yeah. When we look at breast cancer, especially, there's a lot of noise out there about breast cancer. But whether or not that translates to, you know, better access and, you know, cost, whether it's affordable or not, whether or not survivorship, we don't talk about survivorship. We always talk about what it is like to be living with breast cancer. But, you know, in the studio with us, joining us to have this discussion as well, Professor Datin Padukone, Dr. Teo Su Huang, the CEO of the Cancer Research Malaysia. Welcome, Professor Teo. How are you today? I don't know what to call you anymore. Yeah. Is it Professor or Datin Paduka or Doctor?
Please just call me Su. So it's still the same.
I'm still getting used to it. And also joining us, Ranjit Kaur, who is the president of the Breast Cancer Welfare Association. Welcome to the show, Ranjit. How are you today?
Thank you. Feeling good.
Fantastic. Let's talk about breast cancer survival rates. Prof Teo, would you like to just shed some light on survival rates in Malaysia? And, you know, how do we compare across the world?
Well, The Economist published a report quite recently that showed that survival in Malaysia is actually one of the worst in the Asia-Pacific region based on population-based data. So whereas five-year survival for breast cancer was 92% in South Korea and more than 60% in China, 50% in India, it was less than 49% in Malaysia, at least in one particular study. I think more recent studies show that the five-year survival is improving and it's not as bad as what it was in that initial report, but it's still, Malaysia, I would say, is still a laggard behind the other Southeast Asian countries, and it doesn't commensurate with our position in terms of what we expect of our healthcare sector and also what we expect for our own population as a middle or high middle income country.
Okay, I mean, I just saw a report over the weekend about how Malaysia emerged the top country in the world to have the best healthcare system in place. But how do we get there when, you know, we're not doing very well when it comes to the breast cancer front? What is going on? Azrul, any thoughts?
Well, let's just say that for that particular report, if you're an expatriate and you're looking towards getting your disease treated in Malaysia, we provide definitely cheaper rates compared to Singapore, South Korea and the United States. In fact, it's 60 to 80% cheaper in Malaysia compared to those countries. So if you're coming from outside the country and getting self-treated, you're happy to come here. But if you're Malaysian and you're trying to access those private sector healthcare, it could very much be much of a struggle.
Okay. Ranjit, you're a breast cancer survivor yourself.
Yes.
And you've been living for how many years now? It's been, you know, you've done extremely well for yourself. Do you want to just share that journey with us?
Yeah, 21 years ago, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I was working in a company and fortunately covered by insurance. So I went through treatment in a private facility. Went through a lot of roller coaster experience, ups and downs, emotionally, in terms of services, in terms of getting support, as well as finding my way around and getting the right kind of information. And also mostly being influenced by people who are into alternative therapies. And till today, we still have this issue faced by women out there in the community. Yes, I think one of the things that I faced, I realized that because of my background, knowing a lot more scientific information, I knew my direction and what I wanted to do and make sure that I go through the medical treatment. However, there are many people out there who are lost and the difficulty faced by them is enormous.
I'm sure over the 21 years, you've seen a shift in things or things progressing when it comes to how we manage breast cancer.
Not at all.
Really?
Yeah.
over the 21 years.
No.
Prof Teo, you're agreeing. I mean,
yeah, please. Ranjit is absolutely right. So we set up a patient navigation centre in Klang General Hospital, and working together with the Ministry of Health, one of the motivations for setting up this centre was because the head of surgery there was essentially describing how 20 years ago, people presented with stage 3 and 4 disease, and the rate of presentation of stage 3 and 4 disease remains the same 20 years on. So in other words, all of the campaigns that we're doing may be raising awareness mostly among the high-income, high-literacy group, but we're simply not reaching the masses in a way that improves earlier detection of cancer, improves patient adherence to treatment, improves access to treatment. And I think those are major challenges that we really need to find sustainable solutions so that the advances in breast cancer can really be available for more women.
Okay. And how did this project with the Klang Hospital that Cancer Research Malaysia is actually working with, have you seen a difference in how you plan to lower remove barriers to breast cancer treatment and things like that? Could you just share what your findings or where you've come so far?
So in brief, what we sought to do was first really address the hospital-based barriers in terms of rapid diagnosis and resolution. So in other words, if a woman presents with a suspicious lesion, we wanted to make sure that she got rapid assessment to say whether that's cancer or not. Because ultimately, if you don't do that quickly, then a woman is very liable to get all kinds of advice to try alternatives and anything else. And then they become so fearful they never come back to the hospital. So one priority was to make sure that we do rapid diagnosis. The second priority was to make sure that we provide women with support as well as information to go through the treatment cycle and make sure that they are supported through any financial challenges or logistic challenges or family support challenges in order to make sure that they complete their treatment. And all of these things is called what we call patient navigation. Patient navigation is also provided by the NGOs. So BCWA provides patient navigation, NCSM provides patient navigation. But what Cancer Research Malaysia sought to do was to develop a model to demonstrate its impact on actual patient adherence and survival so that we can scale up and provide a better model in many more hospitals. And we're doing exactly that. So we're now expanding from Klang Hospital to other centres in the country.
So it has been a success then?
In a limited way, what we have not yet been able to address is earlier stage at presentation. So phase two of patient navigation program is to really look at how do we now begin to make sure that women present with earlier stage of disease, because you're not really going to improve outcome unless you can get people to come in earlier. Mm. And we must be very clear that earlier stage of presentation is not the same as screening. And we can have a full discussion about what's the difference between early stage of presentation and screening. They're two very different things.
Okay, Ranjit, do you want to add on?
I would like to say that the healthcare service in the country is overburdened. So when a woman typically goes to a hospital and she gets to inform the doctor that this is my problem, I've got a lesion in my breast, she goes through, if she has to have a mammogram, she might need to wait for 1 year.
Really?
Yes.
Up to 1 year?
Up to 1 year. In the teaching hospitals, we know that it's up to 1 year waiting. And if
these
she wants it fast...
Ministry of Education, yeah. Ministry of Education
Hospitals. Ministry of Education Hospitals. I'm not so sure about Ministry of Health Hospitals, and not every Ministry of Health Hospital has mammographic services. And if a woman has a lesion, it is, again, she has to see a medical officer first. Then the medical officer checks her, and that medical officer then refers her to the surgery clinic. And so that takes time. If she's done one trip, and we're talking about, if you're talking about a woman coming, let's say, from Pahang or from someplace further away, she has to take time off from her responsibilities, including caring for children and doing her job or whatever. And or somebody has to drive her. So it's like two or three persons leaving the house to come to the hospital, and then you go for another trip, and there the doctor decides to give just a referral letter, and next gets an appointment, and then after that she goes to see the surgeon, then the surgeon says, okay, now you go for your mammogram, and that's the date. So it's like many the process is quite convoluted, and we are doing a project in Pahang and partly in Selangor in the rural areas, and we faced up with all these issues, and we are now trying to look at how we can fast track for them. And it has been quite a challenge doing the fast track, but we think that we are going to be optimistic, we're going to push, we're going to make sure that this gets done.
Ranjit, last week I think we commemorated World Cancer Day, I think,
yeah.
And one of the things that's been emphasized again and again, and you just did, Prof Teo, a moment ago, which is concerning early detection. Screening is a must. In fact, the government's own programs today emphasize on early detection, and more and more people need to get themselves screened in order for there to be a timely diagnosis. You've just described a problem, which is with regards to that model of getting from people from being screened to getting diagnosis. And you just said that it takes possibly up to a year. So where are we in terms of the quality of screening services in Malaysia? If you were to put it on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being the best and 1 being absolutely nothing, where would you rate Malaysia to be today? Prof Teo.
I think before I answer your question in terms of rating, I would really like to emphasize that for breast cancer, it is very clear that there's a difference between screening and earlier stage of presentation. So screening is screening mammography, and the main aim of screening mammography is to detect disease that you cannot feel with your hand. Yes. That means non-palpable disease. So you're trying to get stage 2 disease to become stage 1 or stage 0 disease. But what we are really talking about in terms of improving survival en masse is getting stage 4 disease to become stage 2 disease. So in other words, you want to make sure that the women who can feel a lump actually get that resolve to say, is it just a benign lump or is it something that could threaten her life? And that doesn't actually require a mammography for screening. It requires a mammography for diagnosis. So it's a different type of thing. So I think the challenge is that the distribution of mammography services in this country is still somewhat lacking. A lot of it in private practice is very well accredited and so on. But there are patches in the country where mammography services require funding to buy new machines. And the simple truth is that we're not investing enough in healthcare. Just like what Ranjit said, the system is overburdened. We simply don't put enough money. We don't have enough money in the coffers to put into buying new machines to cover healthcare services in the country.
So how would you rate us in terms of screening services then? In the government sector?
I would say probably a 3 to 5 out of 10.
Room for improvement, certainly, but linking patients from the screening to timely diagnosis is very much the challenge that we're talking about.
Yeah. We'll come back and find out why is it women present late. I'm sure Ranjit will have tons of examples, being president of the Breast Cancer Welfare Association and being a survivor yourself. That's coming up next on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm Meera Sivisodi. It's our public health series with Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy. And today's discussion is around breast cancer. We're talking about access. We're talking about cost. Why is it Malaysians are presenting late as a very advanced stage of breast cancer when it is highly, highly treatable? I think in stage 1, breast cancer survival rates are more than 95%. Am I correct, Prof Teo?
Yes,
yeah?
That's
more than
correct.
95%, that you wonder why women just don't come early and get it attended to. Our phone lines are open. If you have a question for them, it's 03-7733-29. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Joining us, Professor Datin Paduka, Dr. Teo Siu Huang, CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia, and Ranjit Kaur, who's the President of the Breast Cancer Welfare Association. Ranjit, you want to share with us why is it women seem to be presenting late in Malaysia?
There are multi-factor situations for women who present late. Firstly, they don't have an avenue for mammographic screening. And secondly, many women have a fear of getting cancer, so they go into this feeling that I won't get breast cancer, so I don't need to get myself checked, or I don't need to check. Thirdly, I would say that when they go for their healthcare treatment or any checkups or seeing a doctor face-to-face, has a doctor taken the responsibility to ask, have you ever got your breast checked? Or do you want to get your breast checked? I could get the nurse to check it for you. I don't think that practice is there at all, because women do go more regularly than men to see doctors.
Yes.
Absolutely.
And they may be mothers taking their children. They may be themselves going for their own conditions. Why aren't they being asked by the healthcare professionals as well? Because if you get these messages coming from various sectors, women will be more proactive. And they will start to realize that if the numbers go up in terms of survival rates, women will be more confident about getting themselves checked. When you know that the mortality rate is higher, people are dying due to the disease, you don't want to know about it, and you just don't want to be into that sphere at all.
Yeah. What about the fact that cultural barriers? Are there any?
There may be cultural barriers, but I think cultural barriers can be overcome. I mean, yes, there are cultural barriers. Cultural barriers are, again, linked to the issues that I just talked about. They're not in isolation. So if you say early detection, getting diagnosed at an earlier stage, chances of losing the breast is so low, you know. So then again, you know, the circle, that whole cycle is much more optimistic if you look at early detection.
You know, one of the things that has been emphasized to some degree is the fact that when you look at health inequality, it seems like if you have cardiovascular disease, there's a lot more treatment that's available.
That's true.
If you have cancer, and arguably cancers that affect women, there seems to be less availability of treatment. And again, I'm referring to the public health sector. And you know, we hear a lot about survival rates being much, much better. In fact, in Malaysia, when you look at a five-year survival rate after first diagnosis, it's 60%, I think around 66% for women in Malaysia. But even in China, it's 80%+. Mm. So what is the gap there? Is it also a gender inequality when it comes to the issue of access to treatment for cancer in Malaysia? Is it that Malaysia is somehow missing out in some of these developments that are happening elsewhere around the world?
Well, I think it's still about a distribution of services. So actually, if you live in the Klang Valley, if you live in Penang, or if you live in Johor Bahru, services are incredibly well developed. So in terms of the west coast of Peninsula Malaysia, you kind of throw a stone and you hit a hospital kind of thing, right? So most of the time, you can access services. But the east coast of Peninsula Malaysia, there may only be one radiotherapy centre. There may be only two oncologists. If you start to go to Sarawak and Sabah and Sarawak. I mean, these are huge states, huge geographically large states. And you're talking about one main center for treatment. So the reality is that it's the distribution of services that currently we don't have the funding and the people to man all of these services. So we need to be able to ramp up a greater level of investment in across the entire pipeline. I think oftentimes when we talk about oncological cancer services, we focus only on the oncologists and we count the number of oncologists. Mm. Actually, cures for cancer probably starts with a surgeon.
Yeah.
And it's actually getting access to a good surgeon, getting access to rapid diagnosis and a good pathology report that makes a lot of difference.
Of
so we must be able to look at a more holistic view. It's not as simple as for heart disease, because in heart disease, you might take a blood sample and you do an ECG or a stress test or whatever, and you make a diagnosis on that basis. But for cancer, it's a little bit more complex because it's multidisciplinary.
So if we're talking about addressing gaps in terms of the availability of manpower in order to ensure the best quality of care, we're not just counting oncologists, as you say. We're looking at the radiologists. We're looking at even palliative care, allied care also, to be part of that continuum of care that's needed for cancer care. Am I correct, Prof?
Yeah, absolutely correct. So I think, you know, once we start to talk about cancer, there is too much emphasis on just drugs. And the emphasis oftentimes is on that if I access drugs, I'll get a cure. If I don't access drugs, I'm going to die of cancer. No, actually, it's really not like that at all. It's one important component, but it's not the only component. To really address your point, I really think that ultimately central to cancer is the assumption that cancer, or the big C, equals to death. Fundamentally, that's our belief system. And it's across cultures. So across all religious beliefs, rich or poor, etc., many of us still think cancer equals to death. So at least for breast cancer and early stage breast cancer, we need to get a lot more messages out there that actually early stage cancer is curable. Even metastatic breast cancer, there are many people who are living with metastatic breast cancer 12 years on, 15 years on. They're still around. They still have metastatic disease, but they are still around. And we need to get more of those positive messages out there, because when you see someone else surviving, you're more likely to have a positive outlook and have faith that you will also be able to have that survival.
Yeah, I would like to add to that, like what Su Huang just mentioned, the fact that you know, it is very complex in terms of cancer care. The first thing that the woman wants to get done is to get a diagnosis. she goes to the hospital mainly for that. And if she is being dragged into time issues, then she, you know, gets lost in the entire system, and then she may go for alternative. But then the issue here is, if we have, like, there are surgeons everywhere, but the surgeons can only do surgery after she has been diagnosed. So that's one of the things. So we go to the let's say the smaller hospitals, they do have surgeons, but the surgeons are waiting for the patient to be diagnosed. Only right. then they can do it. You see, so the diagnosis is important. I mean, if let's say you have the system in place for the patient to be diagnosed, the surgery actually increases survival rate. There's a jump in the survival rate. So at least if the surgery is done, other things can come in later. But having said that, the other thing about the services is also the fact that when you were mentioning the fact that radiological services are not well distributed, and they could the short-term measure could be that the government could speak to private hospitals and have a negotiation where their patients could actually be going to private hospitals. Because in many of the cities in Malaysia, we do have private hospitals. They have radiological services for radiotherapy, for even for mammograms. They could buy at a special rate and actually get that
We've
done.
We've been talking about this for yes. the longest yeah. time, you
yes.
know. Public sector tapping into the private sector facility because it's, you know, they can definitely
yeah.
help
so
with
this,
the burden.
This will reduce the suffering yeah. that people are facing.
Okay, but we don't know what's happening yeah. in terms of talks. So all this talk about not having enough oncologists and all of that, is that really a priority, Professor Teo?
Yes. I do think that, you know, it's very clear that for some types of breast cancer, oncological drugs or targeted therapy has made a marked difference in survival. So if you take the drug Herceptin, for example, HER2-positive disease used to have the worst possible outcome. But since the development of Herceptin and other HER2-targeted therapies, it's now become one of the best survival. So in other words, it's completely transformed from a worse outcome to a best outcome disease, right? So if you have those access to oncological services and you are diagnosed and have access and can pay for the treatment, then you have a very different outlook compared to someone who doesn't, you know? So it does make a difference.
Okay. I know, Azrul, when you spoke about the My Salam health insurance scheme recently, it was launched by the government and it provides a payoff of about 8,000 ringgit for those from the B40 who are diagnosed with a critical illness. There are 36 cancers, you know, that it covers. How much do you think the scheme will actually help the patient?
Well, to be honest, when we look at My Salam, what it really is, it's an income replacement scheme. It's not meant to be a health insurance scheme. It's meant to assist recipients upon the diagnosis of a chronic disease. So cancer is one of those 36 that's been identified. So the honest truth is 8,000 ringgit will be quickly be utilized for the paying of transportation, non-medical costs primarily, the cost of treatment itself, if you accessing public healthcare, would be subsumed by and subsidized by the government. So 8,000 ringgit will help, but actually a lot more is actually needed because the non-medical costs will be quite overwhelming. So the My Salam scheme is definitely going to be helpful for the B40, especially when they get diagnosed with these chronic diseases, but it will only go so far. And that is only once in a lifetime, by the way.
Yeah, Ranjit, what did you think of the My Salam scheme?
I think it's a good start. And I think that it needs, as mentioned by the Deputy Health Minister as well, that it's a good start and they will need to review it in the future and see what they can do about it. So I think that you start with this amount first and then see how it goes.
Okay.
Because you really need a review of it. You can't really pluck it from the air and see how much it should be, actually.
Yeah, Prof. Teo?
I agree fully. I think it's a fantastic start. You know, 8,000 is more than 0,000.
Yeah.
So the honest truth is that a cash payout is important at the time that you might be a casual worker. You know, for many people who are on B40, they may be paid a daily wage. And once you have cancer and you have to go to the hospital, you actually go from earning a little bit to earning nothing.
Yeah.
And at least that 8,000 helps you, you know, overcome that first few months, which I think is absolutely critical. But the reality is that it doesn't pay for a lot of treatment. And if we're hoping that it will pay for treatment, then it's going to run out very, very quickly. You just simply don't have enough money
so
if it's just for treatment.
What are the options for the B40 then, Azrul?
Well, the B40, We're very fortunate, I think, to have a government in place today that has made the B40 population to be on its priority.
Yep.
They're looking at different schemes to address issues of inequality and access issues. And one of it is this issue of healthcare. Today, 99% of treatment costs are subsidized by the government. So theoretically, what you could have here is for them to access the public healthcare services. But that just means that there'll be a lot more people accessing. And today you have 70% of the population utilizing, depending on the public services for treatment, even at primary care level. So you have a system that's stressed out. But as to what can be done further, for us at the Galen Centre, our position is really looking at things like social health insurance, for example, mm-hmm. which could help expand the existing pool of funding available for healthcare beyond the existing budget limitations so that you can do more because you can pay more and you can subsidize more. But today, the government is doing what it can do. And as was rightly pointed out, these are pilot stages. At the end of the day, My Salam was just launched like last month. Same thing with PKR B40, which is the NCD screening program. We need to be able to give these schemes time for them to work, but also for us to be able to evaluate what can be improved upon them later. It's too early to rush to judgment concerning these schemes. But here's the kicker is that, as mentioned just now by Prof Teo, is that this is focusing on the most vulnerable, the B40, okay. And that's good.
All right. We'll come back and find out. I mean, what I'm hearing now is people are not coming forward early enough. Women are not coming forward early enough to... we already have a problem in terms of the lack of, facilities. Diagnosis can take up to 1 year in some instances. And then you have patient navigation. How do you help them through from there? But my question then is, if patients were to start coming forward more and more, which is what we want, yeah. And if the system can't cope, yeah. Then how is that going to take the patient forward? You know, we're stuck. How are we going to move? I just want to get your thoughts on what are possible ways in which we can solve this problem that's coming up next after the market update on BFM 89.9.
The Bigger Picture on BFM 89.9, the Business Station.
Good afternoon. It's our Health and Living segment, our public health series with Azrul Muhammad Khalib, the CEO of Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, joining us also to talk about breast cancer, whether or not women are left behind, our Professor Datin Paduka, Dr. Teo Su Huang, CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia, and Ranjit Kaur, who's the President of the Breast Cancer Welfare Association. If you have a question for us, give us a call. The number is 0377332900. You can WhatsApp 018-789-8899 or just tweet us at BFM Radio. Earlier on, before we left off, we spoke about how, diagnosis, rapid diagnosis is something that we want to, start implementing in hospitals, but there seems to be an infrastructural problem when it comes to diagnosis. At the same time, you're also saying women in Malaysia are presenting late as far as breast cancer is concerned, and there are certain barriers. So if we are diagnosing late, or it's taking a long time to diagnose a woman with breast cancer, what happens if we suddenly now get an influx after this show of women coming forward to, get diagnosed for breast cancer? What are we going to do then?
That would be fantastic.
Really? How, Prof? It can take up to a whole year.
Yeah.
No, I think it'll be absolutely fantastic if there's more awareness about breast lumps and the signs and symptoms associated with breast cancer, and that women come forward to have it resolved. Because 9 out of 10 lumps are not going to be cancer, but you need someone professional to kind of figure out whether it is cancer or it's not cancer. Once you have it actually resolved, I think the key point, the key take home is that it's cheaper, less invasive, it costs less and takes less time to treat early stage disease than it costs to treat late stage disease. So actually shifting everybody to early stage will save the government money, will save taxpayers money, and save lives. Why not do it? Absolutely go ahead and do that. We're not increasing the number of cancer cases just because we get women to be more self-aware. We're basically just going to make sure that we shift them to be an earlier stage so that we can put more survivors out there.
I think Mira looks perplexed and she feels that you just told us
she's
that
not the only one here. I'm feeling it myself.
That the healthcare system is so stressed out and overburdened. How are you going to do all this? But I think that it is the citizens' right to access healthcare services. And I do think that the... I have confidence that the healthcare services will step up to the... when this happens, I mean, let's say you get women walking up to the healthcare facility to ask for their services. And I think that the larger the number, the more the impact of wanting to do the change. You know, right now there's like, yes, women need it, but women are not coming to the hospital much. So it doesn't seem like to be like a serious issue. So I think that when there's an influx of women coming in and demanding for to be diagnosed, I think, yes, it will happen.
There will be a greater sense of urgency to actually get things going.
Right.
And then Prof Teo's rapid diagnosis, the need for it will start coming in place. So from Klang, you're going to go to other parts of the country.
That's correct. So we are going to 4 other cities. We're trying to work out which cities have the surgical services that enable us to do the rapid diagnosis and the rapid follow through. And we're evaluating 4 centres at the moment. Hopefully we'll be able to come back and tell you more about how we get on with that. But importantly, I think we're going to primary care. And what we really want to do is just work out how do we get women to come forward for at least a clinical breast exam. How do we, what are the barriers then? You know, do we actually ask nurses to check everybody who comes to a primary care, even if they're there for coughs and colds? I think I shudder to think about that as an option. So we really need to test what ways, what are the interventions that we need to do to get women to come forward. Because it's not just awareness. We can't just organise pink awareness campaigns and expect people to come forward. They just simply don't. Behaviour change needs something different. And we're trying to test interventions that can actually change behaviour.
Azrul, what about policy, Azrul?
Well, you know, Ranjit and Prof Teo, you're both members of the Cancer Care Working Group. And one of the objectives is to engage with policymakers to ensure that there is policy changes that are made for the betterment of increasing the quality and coverage of cancer care in the country. Now, what would you say, what do you need to see changed in the current policy in order to improve, say, the availability of treatment for metastatic breast cancer? You want people to survive stage 3, stage 4. We've been speaking today thus far, you know, about stage 1, stage 2, downgrading people from later
downstaging.
Stage.
Downstaging. Upgrading, in my mind.
Downstaging.
Downstaging or upgrading.
But we want to be able to talk about you getting screened and then you find out that you're stage 3, stage 4, and even metastatic. What do you do? What are your options? How can policy changes help improve upon the survivability of people who come forward and get diagnosed this way? Recommendations.
I only have one wish list, one wish on my list, which is more money in healthcare and healthcare-related research to find out better ways in which we can deliver healthcare to as many people as possible in an equitable way. We simply cannot have a laundry list of all of the things we want without actually having more money in the system. Ultimately, as Malaysians, we need to work out how much of our taxpayers' money do we actually want to put into healthcare and what are our expectations? Should it remain at a low level or should we really raise the bar and put more money into healthcare?
I will speak on behalf of women who have metastatic breast cancer because I work very closely with them. I have seen them suffer and struggle to want to live longer, to be there for their children and for their loved ones. And if there are life-extending treatments, they would want to live longer years for themselves. However, the caveat here is that the drugs are far too expensive for them. And some of them are going into financial catastrophe, paying for all these drugs, and it becomes like a blackmail for them and for their families. So I do think that there is a need to have affordable treatment for them. If there are innovative drugs, they need to be affordable, they need to be cheaper. And who can help with that? I'm not sure. Because as we know that our government doesn't have that kind of money. Perhaps there is an option to look into generics to see if they are cheaper. And so that everybody can have access rather than just the so-called people who are privileged or people who are willing to sell everything and get their treatment done. It is not cheap. You know, it's 15,000 per month for some people, every month for their entire life. And they don't know when to stop because they don't know really what will happen if they stop the drug. So I think that's really, really unfair. You have the drug, but it's not affordable. Unfair to who, to the patients themselves. So I see the suffering by the women who have metastatic breast cancer. So yes, I would like the government to look into generics that would be affordable and for people to have access to them and to continue to live with their loved ones longer and be there to nurture their children.
I think, Ranjit, you're absolutely point on, and certainly this was raised recently throughout the discussion of proposal of a cancer fund by one of the members of parliament. And the issue here really is, how do we make it more affordable? How do we have a situation where there's equity? How do we make sure that people are not separated because of whether or not they can afford these drugs in terms of their survivability? This is where I think the Ministry of Health's approach towards public-private partnerships is actually the right thing to do. We should be talking more about how we can collaborate.
We're still talking,
mm-hmm. definitely. But we need to find those models that that work, right? And having the patients' voices in that discussion is totally key. Need more money for research, but also, most importantly, more money for patients to be able to survive. And we can't just keep paying out of pocket, which is the way that the majority of patients today in the country are actually financing their survival out of their own pockets. It's not sustainable. You're absolutely right, Ranjit.
Any other suggestions as to how we can do this better?
I think number one for me is making sure that the approvals process for biosimilars and generics is as fast as we can make it. Yeah. So in other words, in Malaysia
no shortcuts, is sometimes, though, right?
Yeah, but it's sometimes a little bit slow in terms of that approval process, and sometimes faster. So Ranjit is whispering in my ear and saying all the time, but never mind.
She totally is disagreeing with you, Prof.
I think we need to make sure that we have a rapid approval process for generics as well as biosimilars. I think we need to be innovative in how we negotiate for access to drugs. And if we can negotiate at a country level so that it covers both the private sector and the public sector, and we get a good price overall for that pool, I think we will all benefit, you know, not just from in the public sector, but also in private sector when you're paying out of pocket. But ultimately, the reality is that even the richest countries can't afford all targeted therapies. Even the United Kingdom started a cancer fund and they evaluated it and decided that it was not sustainable. So they pulled the plug on it and discontinued the cancer fund because it was seen to be inequitable to be doing that. So we need to be able to come up with different ways of approaching it. The US is actually starting to think about whether they should actually pay off the patent 2 years into it. Oh, so rather than having a 20-year patent, you pay the pharmaceutical company upfront and you say, we're going to give you $5 billion, but you no longer have a 20-year patent. Now you only have a 2-year patent. And then after that, it's owned by the government and it's free for all, because the pharmaceutical companies are saying it costs us $2 billion to develop any one drug. Yeah. So how about we give you $5 billion and away you go, right? So these are things that it's not just unique to us. I think we must recognize that this is not something that's unique to us, but we must look at how other people are doing it. For now, the trade-offs for the individual patient are terrible, because you're asking a person to trade off. Should I sell my house and my children's legacy in order to survive a couple more months? Should I give up on treatment so that I have something else? The trade-offs are really terrible, and patients are really lost as a consequence of not knowing how to make that decision.
Yeah, I think I have women with metastatic breast cancer who are going through all this treatment. They're still alive 15 years later, and that's because they're paying for the treatment. But I think you said, Teo Suwong, the issue of this whole thing is that not a country negotiating, but it should be the ASEAN region trying to negotiate as a group. Because you have, as Malaysia, we have no power at all. You need to have the power with the numbers. And if you have the region with similar countries getting together and negotiating with pharmaceuticals, or even trying to work it out collectively, the numbers are much higher as people, as patients with metastatic disease. And I think that can be worked out much better.
Correct me if I'm wrong, Azrul, but here even public and private are negotiating separately.
They are. In fact, from
what
the...
What more go to ASEAN? Yeah,
but, you know, that's an excellent...
ASEAN governments.
Yes.
That's an approach that's being discussed at the moment at the regional level, whether everybody should pool together and negotiate as a single region rather than individual countries. So... the thing is, in Malaysia, we need to actually have better negotiators as well, I think. Yeah. We can't depend on having that mechanism, which is still in discussion, for us to be able to get much more affordable drugs. We need to make sure that the best people are able to negotiate the best prices. Because Ranjit pointed out a very interesting point, which we need to remember. Malaysia is a much smaller market compared to Indonesia or China or Thailand. So our ability to get the leverage is smaller compared to these countries. So we need to make sure that we are able to make use of as much advantage as we can to be able to negotiate those prices. Because at the end of the day, we can't depend on biosimilars or generics to become available. We have drugs available now, and we need to get those drugs to the patients who need it now, not 5 years, 6 years down the road, but now. So we need to make sure those drugs are also available as well, because we can't wait.
Yeah. Just to go very quickly through breast cancer awareness campaigns, I think so much is spent every year in October, for an example. Is that something that we should be scaling back on and maybe putting the money somewhere else? I mean, do you not think that awareness is enough? Or
I think
maybe we need to be, the approach needs to be different.
I think the when we talk about these breast cancer awareness campaigns in the community, which are held during the October month, they seem to be just a public public awareness or public relations kind of thing. What BCWA has done is we have changed our approach. Wherever we go, it is either going to be a clinical breast exam by our nurses in the community or even teaching women how to check their breasts. But we try and play down on the issue of, you know, all these campaigns of just putting taglines of early detection and stuff like that, because it has now been just like water down the duck's back. It doesn't make any sense to many people. So the better deal is to practically teach people, to talk to them and to have interactive sessions and ask them, what is the fear? What did you hear about breast cancer? Most of the time when you talk to them, they say it is to do with death. People will die, you know. Yeah. So I think that that kind of interaction is more important, to get feedback from them and to guide them, rather than to just have campaigns running around, you know, with slogans and stuff like that. I prefer that kind of strategy. And that's what we are doing now in the communities. We're going into kampongs and doing that. We are in West Pahang at the moment doing that project. And that is going to be like throughout the year in 2019. And we have already started, and we've and with that has what we have seen is the what the gaps are and what the issues are, where the women are stuck. So as was mentioned just now about how Klang Hospital has come through this whole change, we are trying to do that in other places as well, to work closely with the healthcare services there. But one of the things that I would like to share here is that there was a patient and she needed mammogram. She already had a lesion and she needed a mammogram. So she decided that she'll go to a private hospital for a mammogram. But what happened, we told her that, okay, go there and we will get you to the government hospital. Now, what happened was she was influenced by the private hospital that she has to do the surgery immediately. Otherwise, her breast cancer will get worse. Mm-hmm. And so she went and got her surgery done. And now she wants to be transferred to the government hospital. We can't do that because the government hospital charges first-class rates when she is...
moving
preferred.
From private to
that's true.
Public.
Yeah. Yes. So that's the dilemma again.
Okay.
But I have a slightly different view from Ranjit. I think it's really important to go out in the community and do year-long activities, and that's absolutely critical. But it's not an either-or. You know, for example, we love our family members, but once a year on their birthdays, we make them feel extra special. Why do we bother? Because it's just a reminder that that one special day, you do something different. So once a year, during Pink October, we get awareness among the men as well as among the women that they could bring themselves or their loved ones for a screen. It's just a reminder. And sometimes we all need, you know, we're all leading such busy lives. We need a gentle prod here and there to kind of say, go for your mammogram if you haven't had one, or remember to do your check, etc. It's not sufficient to just run pink campaigns and then that's it, but it is a necessary part of the entire awareness diary, if you like.
Males, men play a role as well, isn't it, in this
Absolutely.
Whole awareness campaign? Yeah,
Boop buddies.
A lot more, because the men think differently from women. Women get very emotional about the situation. Men are more analytical. And so talking to the husband is so much easier when there's a problem, when a woman has a lesion. You sit down and talk to the husband and he realizes differently from the woman. So it's easier to convince the men that take your wife to the hospital now. So he'll say, yes, yes, I'll do that.
We have
otherwise, there's nobody to cook for you. You know?
Olga, thank you very much for your message. Olga is saying he or she wants to share some information where breast cancer screening information that he has heard in Taiwan, they actually use tobacco tax to fund the screening, which is something quite interesting, actually.
Yeah, it's actually something we champion at the Galen Center.
And got a lot of flack for.
Oh, yeah, earmarking syntax for the purposes of funding cancer and diabetes treatment. I think when you look at the billions that we collect from tobacco and alcohol, not to mention gambling, but just tobacco and alcohol, that's like $6 billion a year. We can definitely channel some of that money down towards the treatment of NCDs like cancer and diabetes.
I'm sure. Come on, Minister of Health, I'm sure you're listening to us.
I'm sure the ministers are listening, because Minister of Health, I mean, the current Minister of Health and the Deputy Minister, I think they are really people who have made, they mean business, and they have made changes happen, like, for example, smoking issue.
Yes.
I think that it's such a welcome change, and it's so much optimism for me to see that kind of thing happening, and I'm sure there's a lot more coming for us.
Yes, for sure. We're running out of time. Ranjit, would you have a message?
Yes, I have a message out there to women. Breast cancer does not mean death. Breast cancer means you have a second chance in life. Go get yourself treated and you'll be like me.
Fantastic. 21 years.
Yeah, 21 remarkable. Years.
Good job, Ranjit. Thank you. Prof Teo.
I agree completely with Ranjit. You know, let's stop calling it the big C, but it is something that we can really reverse. Breast cancer at early stage is a curable disease, but at late stage it's a controllable disease, and we need to get the message and the positive stories out there a lot more.
Azrul.
A quick shout out on behalf of the Institute Cancer Negara. They're organising the World Cancer Day Fun Run, 5-kilometre run in Putrajaya on the 23rd of March. I would appeal to everyone to go and participate, because awareness and being informed is a year-long process. And this is an opportunity to get screened, get tested at that particular event. So please do go sign up for this run, 23rd of March in Putrajaya, Institute Cancer Negara.
Are you signing up, Azrul?
Absolutely,
I know, you run, don't you? This is the National Cancer Institute.
It is.
Fantastic. It is. Thank you all very much for sharing your thoughts with us. I think we've got some ideas. We need to just get them through to the right people. Azrul Muhammad Khalib, CEO of the Galen Centre for Health and Social Policy, joined by Professor Datin Paduka, Dr. Teo Su Huang, CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia, and Ranjit Kaur, President of the Breast Cancer Welfare Association, in our public health series on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.